Hi, I'm Veronica Rickard. Glad to be with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. The Republican Party seems to be having an image problem. The current president is wildly unpopular, the war in Iraq not doing much better, and high gas prices coupled with economic angst seem to be making for a jittery American public. This really doesn't seem to be the time for business as usual, so what's a conservative to do? The election in 2008 is on the near horizon, and Karl Rove's get-out-the-base strategy doesn't seem likely to cut it. And Nixon's so-called positive polarization framework looks past its sell-by date, too. This hour, our guest asks the question, have the Republicans run out of ideas? What do you think? What are you looking for in a new conservative movement? Is John McCain the black sheep who can bring home a win? Call us with your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this hour is George Packer. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His book, The Assassin's Gate, was named one of the 10 best books in 2005 by The New York Times. His article, The Fall of Conservatism, appears in the May 26 issue of The New Yorker. George Packer, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
My pleasure.
Give us some of the vitals here. Why are people talking about the decline of conservatism?
Well, I think there's certain things happening that are specific to this year or this election cycle, and there are other things that I think are much older and deeper, and to understand them, you have to go back to the 60s. I mean, right now, all the things you named when you introduced this interview, gas prices, the war, the economy, just the sense that the Bush years were wasted years, and that the opportunity was in Republican hands when they had the White House and both houses of Congress to bring the limited, efficient government that conservatives have always promised to restore American strength around the world because, in their view, Bill Clinton had wasted it, and to make the culture more receptive and salutary for families. And none of those things happen, and in fact, in many ways, their opposite happened. And so by 2006, the public, I think, felt, and the election of that year showed it, that the Republicans had worn out their welcome. And this year, there are signs that there's an even greater revulsion. I mean, the Democratic candidate won three special congressional elections this spring in heavily Republican districts in Illinois, Louisiana, and Mississippi. I mean, these elections scared the wits out of Republicans on Capitol Hill and made them think that a tsunami is headed their way in November, to the point where Newt Gingrich posted a message on a conservative website essentially saying, we're about to get killed unless we change our tune quickly. But exactly what the tune should be changed to was not as clear. So those are the things happening now that are all signs, and no, it's not an original idea of mine, that this is a very bad year to be a Republican, and that the only Republican who might have a chance to win the White House is one like John McCain, who essentially has put a lot of distance between himself and some of his party's less popular figures and policies. But I think the way to understand it in a historical context is that we have had a 40-year run of conservative politics and conservative ideas dominating the American scene, beginning with the 66 congressional election, the 68 election of Richard Nixon, the eclipse of Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. And, of course, in the 80s, conservatism came into its own with Ronald Reagan. And no movement holds the public's loyalty and has its hands on the feelings of the public for 40 years without becoming calcified, out of touch, corrupt, and past. I mean, Republicans today are still asking themselves, what would Reagan do, which is the wrong way to think about how to win an election in 2008. It's the way liberals talked and thought in the 70s and 80s when they were out of favor and trying to figure out how to get back into favor. And so they would ask, what would Kennedy do or what would Roosevelt do? And those, Kennedy and Roosevelt, didn't have the answers to the problems of the 70s and 80s. And Ronald Reagan doesn't have the answers to the problems of the early 21st century.
Well, I want to go back to Nixon for a minute, because you start with him in your article as sort of being there present at the birth of the modern conservative movement that you say has dominated for the past 40 years. And it sounds as though he, along with Pat Buchanan, sort of invented the framework of politics as we've known it, modern politics. And this, in essence, was something called positive polarization. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was the thing that I felt was something people may not remember or know much about today. And that is, where did all this come from? And I had a long conversation in Pat Buchanan's library at his house in Virginia, and he was very gracious and happy to talk about it, because from his point of view, this was the glory days when Nixon and Agnew and Buchanan and a few others sort of invented the strategy of polarization, which in Buchanan's memory was a way to peel off pieces of the old New Deal coalition, Southerners, Northern Catholics, ethnic voters, blue-collar voters, union members, and to find the fault lines between those members of the Democratic coalition and the new left, black Americans, liberal intellectuals. It had become an unwieldy coalition by the 60s, and it kind of blew apart with the student revolution and urban riots and the war in Vietnam. And so Buchanan and Nixon very coldly and methodically set about to manipulate and exploit those divisions in order to create a Republican majority. Another figure here is Kevin Phillips, whose book, The Emerging Republican Majority, from 1969, really sort of put it all in data form. Buchanan set it down in a memo that he gave me a copy of, which has not had much or any public attention, from 1971, in which he just listed all the ways in which the White House should exploit the fissures in the Democratic Party. And it got down to some fairly nasty stuff, like distributing bumper stickers in ghettos calling for a black vice president on the Democratic ticket, which would alienate white voters in the Democratic Party. So Buchanan was a master at reading the mood of certain parts of the electorate, white Southerners, Northern Catholics, and figuring out how to appeal to their resentments, their fears, and their aspirations as well. And
well,
Nixon,
it's pretty interesting.
Nixon was the man who first figured out that the Republican Party could become the majority on that basis.
Well, you talk about some of the words that were sort of born that have so much political capital right now, like elite, mainstream, values, patriotic, liberal. These words, which we think of it as being really potent and crop up in any election, these were sort of born then, too. At least they were given their weight.
They were, and in that Buchanan memo, he talks about exploiting the sense that the liberals who controlled the Democratic Party were elites, that they were out of touch with American values, that they were unpatriotic. All those words were in the kitchen of the Nixon-Buchanan years, and they sort of discovered that populism, which had generally been a left-wing force in America, economic populism, starting in the 1890s, continuing through the New Deal and into the 60s, actually had a right-wing component, which was the resentment of working class and lower middle class whites of the sort of black underclass, as it was called back then, and the white liberal overclass that seemed to be coddling them, and they could fuel the resentment of working class and lower middle class whites by running against the elites in the universities, in the media, and in Washington. And by now, that just seems like, you know, it's a cliche. It's the way Republicans have run pretty much every year. But someone had to invent it, and it was Nixon and Buchanan.
And you talked about the Reagan years being sort of the heyday of this movement and what he accomplished there. At the end of the day, some people are saying what he really accomplished was sort of moving the framework for American politics over to the right, and that was sort of the lasting legacy.
I think that Reagan was more successful rhetorically than in his governing. In other words, he made it impossible for politicians to defend welfare programs or to defend lenient punishment for criminals or to defend a sort of a more pacifist foreign policy. He showed that those were losing positions and that Democrats had to move away from them if they hoped to win, which is what Bill Clinton learned, and that's why Bill Clinton was able to win in 92. But Reagan did not change the federal government nearly as much as conservatives had hoped to do. It was even bigger when he left than when he arrived. Spending was out of control. He cut taxes, and that plus his more muscular defense spending and filling the judiciary with conservative appointees, I think, were his main achievements in government. But the conservative movement ever since the 50s was based on two things, anti-communism and limited government. And when communism ended in 89 and 91, and the federal government seemed resistant to any effort to reduce it, they lost their main point of cohesion and began to lose their way and to lose their power.
Well, fast forwarding now to the 2008 election that we have coming up, a lot of the people that you talk to, you know, conservatives, thought that the election, in a sense, had already been lost unless it was sort of won by default. What is it that people are saying about John McCain and his chances as a different type of conservative?
You know, I was sort of staggered by, I mean, I talked to maybe a dozen conservative writers and thinkers, and I was staggered at their level of pessimism and disgust with the party. And when I reported to friends and editors who were more liberal, they were incredulous because it seems that liberals always expect to lose elections. And the fact that conservatives seem to expect to lose this year was news to them. Basically, the people I talked to think that John McCain, his only chance is to be his best self, which is an independent maverick who doesn't take orders from any part of the Republican coalition. And that's going to be a hard thing to do because for the last few years he actually has been paying fealty to elements of the Christian right. He's changed positions on the Bush tax cuts, et cetera. I mean, he is a conservative man, but he's not an ideologue at all. He's not interested in ideas. He's interested in character. And I think the only hope for that these Republicans seem to have is that John McCain's character will prevail over the revulsion against the Republican Party that seems to be sweeping the country.
But we talk about maybe there being a dearth of ideas in the Republican Party right now. Does John McCain seem to be, to conservatives, the new conservative movement, the face of a new conservative movement, and holding ideas, you know, within that framework? Or is he
absolutely
is
not?
So he's kind of Mr. Right now instead of Mr. Right?
Yeah, he is a kind of an accidental candidate of the moment. If I were to compare him to someone in recent history, it would be Jimmy Carter, who barely won in 76 in the, you know, after Watergate and the pardon of Nixon by Ford, during a decade that really was all about the move of the country to the right. Carter was an accidental president. I think John McCain would be an accidental president. He does not represent a movement. He doesn't represent an idea because he really doesn't have any ideas, as some conservative thinkers complain to me. He's not really interested in a program or in big themes. And you see this in his speeches and his positions. They're all over the map. One day he's talking about, you know, bringing back the forgotten communities of Selma and the Lower Ninth Ward and Appalachia. And then next, he's talking about reducing corporate taxes and unleashing, you know, business from regulation. And he just seems to be kind of zigzagging from one side to the other. And basically, he's trying to be both an independent and to win back the conservative base, which is very suspicious of him, and parts of it hate him. So he's got a difficult job to do. He has to do both at once.
We're talking this hour with George Packer. George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, also the author of The Assassin's Gate. His article, The Fall of Conservatism, appears in the May 26 issue of The New Yorker. What do you think? Are we witnessing the fall of conservatism? Do you think the Republicans need fresh ideas? And if so, what should those ideas be? What areas should they focus on? The number to call with your thoughts is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, about his recent article, The Fall of Conservatism. We're taking your calls, too. What do you think? Do you feel the Republican Party is failing, and what does it need to revitalize itself? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And George Packer, let's take a phone call now. This is Mike calling from Fond du Lac. Hi, Mike, you're up.
Yeah, good morning. I have to disagree with the guest. I actually think he's trapped in his New York state of mind. John McCain is not an accidental candidate at this point. I think he's a necessary evil, frankly. And let me describe why I think that's true. We're at a position in this country where things just aren't getting done. Neither party is willing to cross the aisle and get some kind of consensus on major issues. John McCain has demonstrated that in the past. True conservatives don't like him because of that, and that's one of the reasons he's in the guest mind waffling on some certain issues. He's got to maintain or attract the base of the Republican Party. So my position is that he's a necessary evil at this point in time, because we actually have to try to get something done. He's demonstrated with McCain-Feingold, he's resisted tax cuts that Bush proposed, and a number of other things. He's frankly the only candidate of the three that are currently running that would be able to cross the party, you know, cross the aisle and get something done. And I'd love to hear what the guest thinks of that.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. What do you think, George Packer?
Yeah, I think Mike is right that is the best of McCain's record in the Senate. I mean, Obama claims to be the same kind of politician, but there's less evidence for it in his Senate record. There's also less evidence, period, in his Senate record. But I'm not sure that is in conflict with what I said. I think the idea of a bipartisan reach across the aisle presidency is not at odds with what I called an accidental presidency. What I mean by that is it doesn't represent a turn, a fundamental turn in the Republican Party in a new direction or America in a new direction. Jimmy Carter offered honesty in government and efficiency and sort of managerial pragmatism, and that was his way of sort of evading what was a conservative tide at that time and also playing off on the lies of Watergate. So there's always a message, and there's always a message that fits the moment, whether it's honesty or bipartisanship, but those are not lasting ideological forces. Those are the kinds of presidents who emerge at times when we're in transition. And I think just as Carter was a transitional figure, I think McCain would be a transitional figure.
Our caller called him a necessary evil, and it seems as though in terms of the far right, of the right, that seems to be how they're thinking about him. But is that the kind of candidate that can, as Mike was hoping, get the base out again?
I think it's going to be hard. I mean, one thing I noticed in the Kentucky results, I was staggered by how low Obama's support was in lots of Kentucky counties, including a couple that I visited a few weeks ago. But McCain's support in those same counties was not what you would expect for the man who's already locked up the nomination. Mike Huckabee was in the high teens and low 20s in a number of counties in Kentucky, and that tells me that there's still an important part of the Republican base, and obviously that is more the Christian right, who don't like John McCain and who either won't support him enthusiastically or won't be bothered to go out and vote for him at all, which is why he had to give a speech recently promising to nominate Supreme Court justices like Clarence Thomas and Alito and Roberts, because he's got a real problem with his base. And again, I just don't know how he is going to move to the right and the center at the same time and not appear incoherent, which is how he appears to me right now.
Well, is the base what the Republicans are even trying to get out this election season? A couple pundits in your piece say that that's not going to work this year.
They can't win without it. I mean, George Bush proved that, and Karl Rove proved that the Republican base, plus, you know, small slices of the center of the country, is barely enough to go over 50%. And that was 4 years ago when the Republican base was larger. Right now, those who identify themselves as Republican or supporting Republicans, I think are below 30% or right around 30%. So they can't win without it, but they can't win with it alone. They're in a very difficult position because they have nominated or will nominate a candidate who is going to have a hard time motivating the base, but who at the same time has to sort of affirm or reaffirm to the broader public that he's not a captive of the base. And so the numbers are very difficult for Republicans. This doesn't mean that John McCain doesn't have a chance. I think he's got a very good chance, partly because of some of the weaknesses that Barack Obama has shown in the primaries. But it's not a good year to be a Republican in any case.
All right, we'll go back to the phones and get a call in from Dan in Eau Claire. Hi, Dan. What's up?
Hi. Well, you've got another guy that disagrees with you today.
Go right ahead.
I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'll vote Democrat this fall, and I feel like we're all going over the edge of the cliff. First of all, I really feel like we elect warriors in this country to make peace, and we'll elect John McCain to make peace. We're one terror attack from it being a McCain landslide. Pundits that I watch on the cable news networks see it as a real stretch for Obama to win in traditionally Democratic states. You know, they were talking about Pennsylvania, Ohio. There's a problem there. And the other part of it is that 10% of Americans think Obama went to a Muslim school when he was a kid. 10%? Lunchpail Democrats aren't going to vote for Obama. They've got a problem with him, and I don't know if it's about him being black. I think it's about him being self-righteous.
Can I ask
and
you,
then I've got one more thing to say, and I'll be out of here.
Can I just turn a question over to you? Because you're in Wisconsin. Wisconsin went for Obama. And some people are saying, well, there's a kind of blue-collar Democrat in Kentucky who won't vote for him, but in Oregon and Wisconsin, they will. I think race is inevitably a part of it. I think it's a big part of it. His name is a part of it. His having grown up overseas is a part of it. It all creates this feeling among some people that he's not one of us. But I wonder, in Wisconsin, is that the feeling about him among a broad part of the Democratic coalition that's basically working class?
I see it. We're really fed up with the government as it is, but I see it as it's just too big a hurdle, the Muslim and the black thing. But I got to say it again. You know, I didn't know why I didn't like the man. You know, I'm a Hillary supporter, but there's a self-righteousness about him that I've got a problem with. The other part of it is that you mentioned Pat Buchanan. He can't see Obama winning. You know, I've watched him again and again say that. He says, I don't see how he can carry the average Democratic voter who's voting pocketbook issues.
Right. And will you vote for Obama or for McCain?
Like I said, I'm going right over the cliff. I'm a lifelong Democrat, okay? But I've got, you know, here, I'll put it to you this way. Here's what's interesting. The people that came to our house, and I live in a working-class neighborhood. I'm a college graduate. And the people that came to our house that were for Hillary were lunch-pail Democrats, I'll describe them. The people that came to our house that were for Obama, they had that glint in their eye, the true believer glint that as an old-line Democrat kind of scares me. I was for Fred Harris in 72, and I'm 76, and McGovern in 72, and I had that same glint in my eye, okay? but, you know, they just kind of put me off because, like I said, I feel like we're going over a cliff here. Mm. I feel like we're, you know, one terror attack from a McCain landslide.
You know, you could do me a real favor, sir, by leaving your contact info with the radio station, because I'd love to follow up with you if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. That'd be great.
This is a very interesting conversation. You know, I think what you're saying is not at odds with my larger point that the conservative era is over. I think what we're now talking about are personalities and the quirks of the two contenders, McCain and Obama. And if McCain wins, I repeat, it'll be less because Republicans have somehow won back the country's faith that they have the solutions to our problems than that McCain appealed to people more than Obama. And I think that's absolutely possible. I think you're right. But I'd love to talk to you more if you wouldn't mind leaving your information behind.
All right, thanks.
After you get off the air.
Thanks a lot, Dan. And you can leave your information with our call screener. She'll pick you up again there, and we'll have that for George Packer at the end of the hour. Thanks for that call, Dan. And George Packer, I wonder, you know, if we're talking about personalities now, does that mean that we're also witnessing the disintegration of that sort of template of politics where it is sort of pitting one group against another group?
Well, that's the view of a lot of smart people out there, that we've kind of reached the end of an ideological era, and people are now looking just for anyone who can solve their problem. And the previous caller said McCain appeals to people because that's what he does. He works across the aisle. But, you know, if you look at the last 100 years, there's always been some set of ideas or some vision that's been on the ascendancy and another that's been on the decline. And at the beginning of the century, you might call it Republican industrialism was on the ascendancy. In the middle of the century, New Deal liberalism was on the ascendancy. At the end, it was modern conservatism. I don't know what the next 30 or 40 years are going to be like. That's why this is such a fascinating year to try to figure it out. But I do think that our history has had, you know, characteristics, ideological characteristics, even though Americans don't like to think of themselves as ideological. And there's no reason to think that the next few decades won't as well. We just don't know what it is yet.
Let's take a phone call now from Mary in Madison.
Oh, that was a very funny call. I love the part about the true believer, and that's what's worried many of us about Obama. After the absolute hysteria of electing a half-black president is over, if that's the way it goes, I think there's going to be a tremendous morning after. He's raised expectations about things he cannot possibly do. Nobody could. And to jump from being a junior senator who apparently made absolutely no impact on anybody, which is not unusual, to being president and proposing, by implication only, perhaps, that he can overturn the entire structure of this country is a simply breathtaking leap. And I watch with fascination as he is this blank slate for everybody's wildly unrealistic hopes. However, that is not what I called to say. I think the biggest problem with conservatism is having watched it in action. And many of us just are riveted by the spectacle of the party's prominent conservatives cutting their own private deal and taking absolute advantage with their money and their ability to buy, they hope, privacy. Of all of the new social freedoms, as they say, every year the wives get younger, every more and more of them seem to be going to these high-end escort services. And whether you're talking about Limbaugh or Gingrich or Spitzer or any of the group, they have no more intention of being restricted and put in a box by conservative principles, as I understand them to be espoused, than anybody that's 20 years old today. And as a woman, speaking personally, as we tend to do, the absolute arrogance of one of these dead white males telling a young woman what to do with her body is just enough. Now, I grew up in a very conservative family. I think it's still very much the way to raise kids, the best way. What I notice is that the true working dyed-in-the-wool conservatives are going under financially and socially all around me. They can't begin to make a living. Their children refuse to abide by their principles, particularly their female children. And I cannot imagine that 4 more years of this is going to get us anywhere.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mary. I think Mary is expressing being sort of unhappy with the fruits of conservatism as it's been enacted the last 30 years. Is that, do you think, how many conservatives are feeling?
Well, she's talking about good old-fashioned hypocrisy, which is certainly alive and with us, and all the more so among politicians who rose to power in the 90s, in part by throwing stones at the personal life of the president, and then suddenly seemed to have some of the same problems. Pat Buchanan said to me, and this is a man who has made a career out of pithy phrases, although he was citing the social critic Eric Hoffer, he said, every great cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and eventually degenerates into a racket. And I think that's not a, and he said that is what's happened to conservatism, and I think he's basically right. By the Bush years, it had become a way for politicians and lobbyists to fatten off each other. Government expanded. It didn't contract during Bush's presidency. Congress never met an earmark it didn't like, and it became corrupt. And that's, I think that's almost inevitable when movements are in power for that long. And it happened to the Democrats in Congress, which is why they got thrown out in 94. So it's nothing new particularly, but it is, to me, a sign that it had reached the point of sclerosis. And the other symptoms of that are a sort of brain-dead conservative journalism, where you've got magazines and newspapers that cannot allow heterodox opinions, that couldn't see that the Iraq war was being lost when it was as clear as day. Conservative think tanks that continue to worship the past, the Reagan years, and look for anyone who can bring them back. So these are all signs, and liberals will recognize them from their own years in the wilderness, that these are the signs of a movement that has been bypassed by history, because they're now problems that conservatives for years have not only not had answers for, but have even denied existed. The healthcare crisis, global warming, income inequality. I can't tell you how many op-eds and talk show chatterers I've read or heard who have denied that these things even existed or were problems that we should worry about. Now they're central to the public's concern, and the smartest younger conservatives are beginning to realize that they have to find answers for them.
Well, there is a lot of the sense among conservatives, especially the younger conservatives, as you're talking about, that the party needs new ideas. Are people out there? Are people think tanking this right now? Are there ideas being floated that have the potential to be the seeds of that new movement?
You know, what I found is they're not think tanking it, because the institutions are part of the problem. The only daylight is outside the institutions among sort of freelance conservatives. I met a young guy named Ross Douthat, who, along with another young guy named Rehan Salem, are about to publish a book called Grand New Party, which is a sort of a cri de coeur for conservatives to remember that the working class is their base, and that they have lost its support, and that they need to get it back by paying attention to its problems. And it's the best book that I read, as far as sort of recognizing how out of touch conservatism had gotten and what it might need to do to get back in touch. But most conservatives are still simply singing the same song louder, saying small government, low taxes, let's get back to Goldwater Reagan basics. And I just think we're no longer living in that era.
We're going to take a break right now as we talk with George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's the author of the article, The Fall of Conservatism, which appears in the May 26th issue of The New Yorker. What do you think? Do you think we are witnessing the fall of conservatism? What new ideas do you think are needed to revitalize the Republican Party? Give us your call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'd be happy to hear from you today. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, I'm back with you again on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, about his article, The Fall of Conservatism, which appears in the May 26th issue. And George Packer, we'll go back to the phones now. We've got a call waiting here from Nick in Milwaukee. Welcome, Nick.
Hello. I just wanted to say, I think the best route that conservatism can take is to emulate the British conservatives and the Canadian conservatives. They've gone more towards appealing towards the middle class and the middle of the road policies. I mean, with David Cameron and Stephen Harper, it's not at all what Margaret Thatcher or Brian Mulroney were advocating in the 80s. And I think you can even see that here in this country with a little bit with Governor Schwarzenegger in California and maybe even Governor Jindal in Louisiana.
I think you're absolutely right, and people like David Brooks and Andrew Sullivan have been saying something like that as well. But that won't happen without a civil war in the Republican Party that will be every bit as bloody as the left-center battles in the Democratic Party of the 1980s, because Schwarzenegger holds positions that are anathema, as you know, to the 30% of the country that is the Republican base, and it's gonna go kicking and screaming into the era of social tolerance and other parts of the coalition, Wall Street, corporations will go kicking and screaming into the era of a targeted tax policy for the working class rather than simply a across-the-board cut. So these are battles that are going to happen in the next few years, and they're going to be interesting to watch, but they won't happen without a lot of blood on the floor.
So speaking of a civil war in the Republican Party, if John McCain does win the election in 2008, are we going to see sort of an end to the soul-searching for the time being in the Republican Party?
I don't think so, because McCain, as president, will be unable to enact conservative policies. He may get a justice or two appointed, although I think the Democrats are going to put up more of a fight. And he will keep us in Iraq longer than Obama or Clinton would. But basically, he's going to be presiding over a center-left government with a strongly Democratic Congress. One conservative, David Frum, suggested to me that McCain should see himself as a French-style president, sort of in charge of foreign policy, representing the nation, but allowing Parliament to handle domestic policy. So I think that he will disappoint conservatives because the Democrats will have their way in Congress. And so he's not going to solve these basic core problems that I've been describing that are at the heart of the Republican Party today. If McCain loses, it'll be interesting to see which of the two responses to defeat will prevail. Will it be the purist response, which is let's go back to Reagan and Goldwater and core principles, or will it be the reformist response, which says we have to find solutions to the problems of today, not to the problems of the 80s?
So how analogous would a McCain presidency be with a Democratic-controlled Congress to Clinton's presidency with a Republican-controlled Congress?
That's a very interesting question and a good sort of historical analogy. The question will be this. Would the Democratic Congress see itself as simply blocking everything McCain tries to do, which is how the Republican Congress behaved in the 90s? Or will it try to use its majority to achieve positive programs, such as health care reform? In other words, will the Democrats use the power they have to try to change government or to try to check the power of the presidency? And my guess is the latter will be a lot easier than the former, but Democrats are more disposed to see government as having solutions, and so my guess is they will try, whereas the Republican Congress of the 90s saw its mission as almost to disable the workings of government, and eventually they shut it down. So because the parties are so different, the behavior might be different, but I think they'll be tempted to emulate the Republicans of the 90s because it's much easier to block than it is to create something new.
Well, that was during Newt Gingrich's era as well, which must make a difference. I don't know if there's a figure like that right now.
Is there a sort of firebrand
right
leader for the Democrats in Congress? I don't see it either. And also, the Democrats are not nearly as united as the Republicans were. I mean, the 94 Congress was a conservative Congress, no doubt about it. There were, you know, how many moderates in the House and Senate left by the time George Bush became president? They're an endangered species, and Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island has written a book about that that's just come out. The Democrats, on the other hand, have always been, you know, as Will Rogers said, I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat. That's been the case forever. It will be the case with the new Congress. A lot of the Southern and Western Democrats are going to be more conservative on some issues, like Jim Webb of Virginia, John Tester of Montana. So it'll be harder for them. And they just don't have the same party discipline that Republicans do. So I think it'll be very difficult for them to vote as a bloc and prevent President McCain from achieving anything.
Going back to the phones, here's a call now from Louis in Wausau. Hi, Louis, you're on the air.
Thank you. Mr. Packer, I bought your book last year. I just finished reading it. It took me so long because every time I reached for it, I was filled with dread.
And, I'm sorry,
and
I made you hear
that
dreadful one.
Not a insult. But anyway, my comment is this, that I have concluded that the Republicans never did have ideas. What they had was ideology.
That is, I think, partly true, and they also had political strategy and tactics, which is what they were best at, and that's where we go back to Nixon and Buchanan. But I guess if you say ideology, you must mean a kind of inflexible program that has the same answer to every question.
Faith-based beliefs. That,
right, right.
You know, not corroborated by evidence.
You know, I think that was more and more true in the 90s and especially under Bush, during which people were appointed and policies were implemented entirely on ideological basis. But I think in the Reagan years, you're not quite being fair to them because they had an idea about welfare reform that eventually became law that was a real idea, which is that, you know, welfare had a destructive effect and that it needed to be reformed in order to function properly. They had an idea about business that it needed to be deregulated in order to produce more wealth. They may not be ideas that you like, but I think that it would be hard to say they weren't ideas at all. But more and more, especially after their successes, in some ways they were the victims of their successes, their ideas hardened into ideology, and I think you're absolutely right about that.
Well, and you do make a point in your article that a lot of people say that the movement is struggling now because it did what it wanted to do, especially, you know, during the Reagan era with the ending of the Cold War and the tax breaks, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the high water mark was 89, when Reagan left office and the Cold War ended. And right before his death, William F. Buckley, who was in many ways the intellectual father of the modern conservative movement, or at least the uncle of it, sort of understood that the fall of communism, the successes of Reagan, had taken away the things that held the movement together. And in the 90s, and especially in the last few years, its inherent tensions began to split it apart, so that you had, in this presidential season, you had the candidate of the Christian conservatives, Mike Huckabee. You had the candidate of the economic conservatives, Mitt Romney. You had the candidate of the national security conservatives, John McCain. You had the candidate of sort of the Republicans who wanted the party to be more moderate, and that was Rudy Giuliani. And there was a striking sort of incoherence to the Republican candidates this year. There was no single candidate who represented the whole party, which is why I think it fell to McCain by default, which is why, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, I think he's an accidental candidate and he would be an accidental president.
Well, thank you for your call, Louie, and we'll take one now from Will in Wauwatosa. Welcome, Will.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I never read that article, and it sounds like a great article because I think that, and I'd like your guest to comment on this, I think that a big part of the fall of communism is due to the fact that all the younger voters, 18 to 25, which includes myself, are taking a serious interest in this campaign because we associate Republican with helping big oil and big business and helping the people who have money and just not looking out for the concerns of the average American family, and it distresses us. Mm. I think is that a big part of the fall of communism, conservatism?
Some would find there to be some similarities. Well, let me ask you, are you one of those Obama true believers with a gleam in your eye that an earlier caller was talking about?
Absolutely. I laughed when he said that because, you know, Obama is the first guy to stand up and say, look, the government's broken. Why are we giving money to the rich? Why are farmers getting huge subsidies? And Obama was the guy to say the government's broken.
Well, here's your chance to
hope.
And this is a very important thing you have to do to convince Democrats who supported Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin that he can do what he says, because the earlier caller asked, you know, why does anyone think that this man is going to be able to deliver the promised land? He's overpromised, and he's going to be a big disappointment to his followers. Why have you signed on to his campaign?
Because at least he's saying he's going to try. I granted, I understand that there's evils on both sides, and they all say what you know, they think that people want to hear, but, you know, it's what I want to hear, and it's what I want to see. And if somebody's going to stand up and say, okay, I'll try it, I'm going to be behind them 100%. I've never been so involved in election. I got, you know, I rally around, and I got a plethora of people that I have that are voting for Obama, and they're going to go out and they're going to vote, and they're all younger people that just don't have faith in the government anymore.
And do you know Hillary supporters, and are they going to stay with the Democratic Party in the fall?
Honestly, I haven't yet met a Hillary supporter except for my father, and he will definitely stay Democratic in the fall.
Okay, start at home and work outward from there.
Yeah. Big part of it with all the young voters and the way we see the Republicans and what they've done.
I missed the beginning of that. I'm sorry.
Could you say that once more, caller?
Do you think that was a big part of the fall of conservatism is all the younger voters coming out with just a lack of faith in the Republicans because of what they've shown that they're going to do?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I saw a survey recently that said of people under 30, two-thirds identify with the Democrats, one-third with the Republicans. I mean, that's a staggering differential, and it's a huge change from 2004. Reagan won over young voters because he made them feel as if he represented the future. And I think people your age look at the Republican Party and see a bloated and corrupt and out-of-touch party that hasn't even raised the right questions, let alone found the answers. And so naturally, younger people are looking for an alternative, and I think Barack Obama has become the recipient of that quest. Yeah, absolutely. One intellectual who I talked to for this article proposed that as Reagan was to Goldwater, Obama will be to McGovern. And by that he meant Reagan brought the conservative movement that Goldwater began into power, even though Goldwater lost in a landslide. And Obama might do the same for liberalism, even though McGovern lost in a landslide. But my question about this campaign is whether the old McGovern coalition of minorities and young people and well-off liberal voters can win an election, or will they need people who are voting for Hillary in the primary and who are skeptical of Obama? That's the central question for this election.
Let's try to get one more call in here. Time for Ed in West Dallas. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
When the evil triplets in the 1950s founded National Review, Greenspan, Buckley, and Ayn Rand, they had one goal. Organized labor at that time was 52.3% of the workforce. We're now at 7.8%. They have been very successful. Their goal was to destroy organized labor. Had we gone out in 1981, 82, 83 and created panics in the streets, this never would have happened. In terms of your looking at what's going to happen in the fall here in November, there is no dislocated blue-collar worker after the comments in San Francisco from Barack Obama and that insensitivity, especially in Wisconsin, who is going to vote for him. And have a strong working-class third-party candidate in November, he would be getting 15 to 30% of the vote here in Wisconsin.
And is that organized labor or just labor, organized and
the dislocated worker movement? We have been decimated in this state by Republicans.
Sorry, Ed, we're running out of time.
Yeah.
George Packer, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, is that strictly because of what Obama said in San Francisco, or more broadly because of who he seems to be?
That and scoring 39 at a bowling alley in Pennsylvania.
Is that really enough to lose your vote?
He didn't get my vote from the very beginning because of his anti-union animus and his Reaganism. If you look at his rhetoric, he is very crafty in terms of emulating Ronald Reagan. And if you read his book, and this was true even in the 1980s when he was doing community organizing, and I knew him down in Chicago.
Okay. It sounds like you've got a story there. I guess we've run out of time, though.
We have, and I do thank you for your time, George Packer. It's been a great hour. Obviously, we could go on much longer about this, but I wish you luck. Thank you for being with us.
You've got very good callers. Thanks
Definitely.
For the chance to talk to them.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
We've been talking with George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, was named one of the 10 best books of 2005 by The New York Times. His article, The Fall of Conservatism, appears in the May 26 issue of The New Yorker. I want to thank Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and Brittany DeAnda for on-air production. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 523E. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.